Well, welcome everyone. Welcome to the Tori Says Show. I'm your host, Tori. So today is Constitution Day, and I thought we'd talk about the Constitution. But before we do that, I have to thank someone that has had their eyes open on something and brought it to my attention literally 2 minutes before I went live. I'm going to show you something that's going to piss you off. So we all know that I filed a federal lawsuit with a TRO. The TRO was shot down, and it was expected to be shot down since the judge sat on it and took his time 2 weeks. And the law firm that's representing me, representing the school board, is not this one. Yet for some reason, they're advertising a loss and how it's important that you need to hire this firm because PM, through her parent, filed and parents can't represent kids and health mask mandates and. These people here have taken a case where only the TRO was declined, not the preliminary injunction, none of the others, just the TRO. And they are now pushing it. Do you know why they do this? For fear porn. And because they know there are other school boards that are getting sued. So they're like, oh, look, we know about this. Let me tell you about it. See, that's the funny part. That they have started advertising how it's gone when it's only the TRO, not the preliminary. I will win. The law is on my side. The Constitution is on my side. And if that fucking judge wants to end his career being removed from the bench for violating his oath, then so be it. The bottom line here is that they are advertising that children have no way to defend themselves and how mask policies will stay. Well, fuck, they won't. So these people here jumped on the wagon. They're thirsty. These are ambulance chasers. But the person who sent me this has spent time in law, a little over a decade. And they were like, I have never seen something like this where they're advertising using a case that hasn't even been completed as advertising. This is a psyop, my friends. I want you guys to pay attention to what they are doing. It is disgusting. I can't even believe that this law firm would sit there and embarrass themselves like this. I think they need to be showcased. I think they should be talked to. The court found that not likely to succeed on merits of constitutional claim because wearing a mask does not impede her from attending school or otherwise violate the 14th Amendment. Well, they haven't seen the amendment to the fucking case, which I am due to file within 21 days as the law allows me from the day that I filed it. And wait till you see all the other fucking amendments that I'm going to pull out of my ass as ammo, because I'm going to drop them all at his feet. And I'm going to have the judge really take a hard look before he makes any decision. And also spell it out in plain English. If you rule on stating that I cannot represent my kids' civil liberties, then you're telling the people of Ohio that children from families that are considered middle class, low class, or in poverty are not allowed to defend their civil rights. Therefore, you are saying that the majority of the children in the state of Ohio should not be afforded any civil liberties. That's plain English, because that ruling, that is exactly what it says. And I think it's very important that that needs to be stated in layman, plain English and made public record forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. So having said that and showing you this really shitty ambulance chasing firm, looks pretty hungry by going out on this. Who's this Costler and Sarah Katz? Maybe they're into diversity and shit too. Losers. We'll deal with them later. For now, we should talk about the Constitution, how important it is and how it's being maimed right now and how no one's really paying attention to the Constitution. And you know what? Actually, Governor DeSantis, who's been battling unconstitutional attacks on his state by people, actually said it best. Take a listen.
Hello, this is Governor Ron DeSantis wishing everybody a happy Constitution Day. And on this day, it's worth reflecting on how fortunate the United States of America is to have inherited a strong written constitution. That was not the norm when our country was founded. Our country was founded on the idea that our rights come from our creator, not from government. And the constitution that was framed by our founding fathers was designed to protect our pre-existing rights and to create a framework of government that would preserve individual freedom. And that framework has served us well. At the same time, we see a lot of threats in recent years to the Constitution. It requires eternal vigilance. As President Reagan said, freedom is one generation away from going extinct. It's not passed along in the bloodstream. When Benjamin Franklin left the Constitutional Convention, which was conducted in secret, he was asked on the street of Philadelphia by somebody, "Dr. Franklin, what have you given us, a republic or a monarchy?" And Dr. Franklin responded, "A republic if you can keep it." They understood you could have an important framework. They understood it was necessary to have a strong framework, but they also understood the success of the Constitution and a republican system of government would ultimately depend on the vigilance of the American people. Take time to reflect on how lucky we are, but also take time to reflect on the challenges that are before us. Thank you and God bless you.
Challenges before us. What an understatement. But there are people that are rising to the challenge. There are many people rising to the challenge at the moment. We have citizens across this nation right now, and among them are the Tory Says family, of course, that have been defending the Constitution, that have been pushing that it is upheld. And that is something that all of us should be extremely, extremely proud of, because nothing happens without a fight. I've said this many times before. You cannot be free. You will never be free if you don't fight for it. And for those of you that are standing idly waiting for others to do it, well, guess what? You're not going to be free on the backs of others. I'm telling you that right now. You'll see. You'll see how that changes, how you come last, how things will happen. You will see. You must take a stand yourself. And you know what? I am so proud of the people in these states. And I'll start with one of the lawsuits, which you saw that law firm advertised was a failure. Failure, obviously. What? The TRO? Are you kidding? We expected that. But one of the filings on that day that we all went was at Cloverleaf in Medina County. And I want you to listen to what the news reported out of all those four cases. They picked that one. Take a listen.
Our children and teenagers who are getting COVID-19 and then spreading it to their classmates at school. The situation now has hundreds of districts debating and enforcing mask mandates. And that's a topic that's become a flashpoint for some parents. Our Adrian DiPiazza is following this story very, very closely. Joins us now from the newsroom live with where the mask mandate is now heading to court. Adrian.
Stephanie, that's right. Children's hospitals throughout the state encourage masks to be worn in schools, but a parent in one Medina County school is now suing the district over its mask mandate, saying it causes irreparable harm to her kids. In the lawsuit, the Cloverleaf local school's mom claims masks cause a variety of health issues for her kids. The district mandated masks when dozens.
How are you guys hearing an echo? There's nothing else playing anywhere. Can you guys refresh?
The students and staff became sick and hundreds had to quarantine. The superintendent later told parents quarantine numbers dropped after the mandate. Meanwhile, other schools are grappling with their own decision. Parma City Schools will require masks indoors starting Monday. They've had 130 cases of COVID and 800 students quarantined. Oroville Schools will also mandate masks next week. And after a heated board meeting at Riverside Schools in Painesville, the school board voted not to require masks.
My mask protects you.
Soy,
your
man.
Your mask protects me.
What a soy idiot.
If you use them together, they can provide a little bit of protection. It may not be perfect, and we still may have some kids getting sick.
Oh my God,
but
imagine him being your dad.
What you're doing is you're charting a course to sending all of our kids to doing remote learning.
Today I went to Miller's to drop something off for my daughter, and I walked in and I saw lunchroom full of kids laughing, playing, running around, having fun. And I'm just thinking that We're going to take this away from them again for something that is less dangerous to them to the flu.
Now, Riverside has had 93 positive cases and more than 250.
And they're quarantining the kids. You know, if anyone told me, oh, your kid needs to quarantine, unless they're vaccinated or masked and they're around with someone with COVID, they got to stay home. Fuck you. My kid's not staying home. She has the right to education. Unless she's sick, she's not staying home. She doesn't even go to school if she's coughing. So that's happening in Ohio. Now, speaking of that, let's take state constitutions into account. I think we should start with Idaho, which is another state where we had a writ of mandamus filed against the governor. This is why this story is quite interesting. The deputy AG says the Lieutenant Governor McGeering's order likely violated Idaho Constitution and Idaho Code. What?
24 hours ago, we're all wondering the same thing, and we kind of alluded to it, or at least Joe did with his story there. Was this executive order even legal? Well, it takes an official request from a sitting member of the Idaho legislature to find out from the state's attorney general, which is exactly what Senator Melissa Wintrow did after seeing that executive order issued yesterday. And Deputy Attorney General Brian Kane responded today. Senator Wintrow sent him a three-question inquiry. The first, does the executive order issued by the acting governor exceed the governor's powers? Well, according to Idaho Code Section 67802, the Deputy Attorney General said, well, yes, it does. The supreme executive power of the state is vested by Section 5, Article 4 of the Constitution of the State of Idaho in the governor, who is expressly charged with the duty of seeing that the laws are faithfully executed. And if need be, in order to make sure that happens, the governor can issue executive orders from time to time, which carry the force of law. So orders are meant to ensure laws are faithfully executed. However, in regards to this executive order to ban mask mandates, since there is no existing law prohibiting such mandates, Acting Governor McGeehan has exceeded the executive order authority granted her under Idaho Code Section 67802. Not only does this executive order not seek to ensure laws are faithfully executed, oddly, it seems to have been issued in an effort to undermine the existing authorities of the state and its political subdivisions to issue mask mandates. In fact, wrote Kane, this executive order appears to run counter to both the Idaho Constitution and the governor's statutory executive order authority. And because there is no existing law about mask mandates, this executive order seems to have created one. You can just do that, thus encroaching on the lawmaking power of the legislature, violating the separation powers of the branches of government, which answers Senator Wintrow's second question. Her third question was, does it violate or conflict with what the Constitution allows cities, counties, public health districts, or school districts to do in regard to public health? Stating several Idaho codes that give such local entities the power to do that, the opinion from Mr. Kane states McGeehan's executive order didn't cite any reasons to remove that local authority. So in conclusion, to answer your questions, Senator Wintrow, yes. The executive order issued yesterday by the acting governor was unconstitutional, illegal, and executive overreach, according to the state's attorney general's office, which leaves just one question unanswered. Are we going with overreaching McGeehan or overreeing McGeehan?
Sounds like the writ of mandamus filed in the state of Ohio will be highly successful because the attorney general came out today to make that statement and make it clear that it is overreach, that it is unconstitutional. Now, Tory, AG came out today. No, actually, he came out in May. So then why the fuck do they have masks in Idaho? That's a very good question. And the Supreme Court of Idaho will deal with that. So great job, Idaho. Great job, Idaho. Now that's what's up. These are the things that we need to be paying attention to. The details, knowing the laws, knowing our state laws, knowing our state constitutions, because they're very important. Now let's move up to the state of Washington. Did you know that in the state of Washington, they have hidden rights within the Washington state constitution? I kid you not. There's a guy who made a video about just that. Take a listen.
Citizens, which are above beyond and beyond protections offered by the United States Constitution to Americans in general. I will also share some of the problems that the Washington constitutional framers were concerned about 100 years after the framing of the United States, which is when Washington State was ratified, and how they addressed those problems at the time. We may find that we can address modern problems today in a similar fashion. And lastly, I'm going to show you why the language of the Washington State Constitution is incredibly relevant and practical today. You may be able to relate to this. In the 12 years that you spent in the public school system, which equates to about 15,000 hours of classroom time, you learned very, 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 very little of what you would consider practical or applicable to real life. Even if you were lucky to have some sort of civics education, which I would assume that you got to be at least 50 years old to have, I never had any, chances are the scope of that education was very limited. And I would say chances are even better that you didn't learn anything at all about your state constitution. Now, I went searching for resources on the history of Washington, its government, and its politics. After enough digging, I was able to find some resources and articles on a University of Washington website that were exactly what I was looking for. What I found, quite honestly, blew my mind, and I want to share some of the things that I learned with my fellow Washingtonians and encourage everyone in other states to start digging into their own state constitutions to see if you might find something similar. So what did I find that was so interesting? What I found was that the Washington State framers were somewhat antagonistic and you could say even hostile to the concept of natural rights. Now, I understand this sounds really bad, and it also sounds very strange that an American state dedicated to the concept of freedom would say, hey, we have a problem with this thing called natural rights. Well, let me explain why that was the case and why there's something very important to learn from how the Washington State framers avoided the usage of natural rights and instead replaced it with this concept of individual rights. Now, of course, in 1789, when the United States Constitution was being framed, natural rights was on the tip of everybody's tongue, really getting its momentum from philosophers like Spinoza and John Locke, and really crystallizing in the philosophy of Thomas Paine, who I have on the wall, who I will argue is the founding father of the United States. Not the Constitution, he was absent for that, but for the moral and principled aspect of the United States, it was him. The framers of the United States were very, very concerned about the powers of government and were continuously working into the, whether it was the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, saying Congress shall pass no law restricting the right of blank, shall not pass any law infringing on the right of blank. Nothing like that is in the Washington State Constitution. In fact, the Washington State Constitution really tried to avoid the uses of the word law when talking about rights. This is interesting. So why would this be the case? So in 1889, which is when Washington was ratified, the framers were very, very aware of abuses of rights, not just from government. So remember, this is 100 years after the fact of the United States Constitution. And we're like, this era is full speed ahead into the Industrial Revolution, where you start seeing these corporations and businesses acquire so much power that particularly if they're in a frontier area like Washington State, which in 1879, which is the first time a constitution was attempted, there was approximately only 75,000 settlers here. These corporations could essentially act like governments where they move in, they've got all the money, they got all the technology, and a bunch of sparsely populated, not united settlers couldn't really do much against the fact if, you know, this railroad wanted to build this here or they wanted to control this section of land or these mining companies wanted to issue their own currency to pay for work, you know, for workers. I mean, if you don't have a job and you need something to do, what are you going to do against these guys? So the Washington framers looked at this. They were very aware of this issue of breaches of corporate power on top. And, you know, not to minimize the breaches of government power, they're very aware of that. But they said, okay, there's more than just government breaches of power and government infringement on rights. Private institutions can also infringe on rights, and that's a problem. And you can see this in the Washington State Constitution, for example, in Article 1, Section 24, which is essentially the Second Amendment of the Washington State Constitution. It says individuals have the right to bear arms. However, this should not be construed as giving individuals or corporations the right to organize, maintain, or employ private armies. Now, I remember when I first read that, I laughed because I knew the only reason that that would be in there is if it was a problem at the time. And lo and behold, there was two very famous examples leading, you know, right before the state was framed, of mining companies who had hired armed guards to quell striking miners. Another example is Article 2, Section 38, which is this, when you read it today, this seems very strange, but it forbids railroad companies from offering free transportation to public officers. Now, why would something like that be so important that they had to write it into the Constitution? And if you think about it, if you've got this very sparsely populated area, and these railroad companies come in, and the only modern form of transportation is railroads, if you can control pricing and say, okay, for you, I'm going to charge $1,000 a ticket, and for you, I'm going to give you a free ride, because you're politician A, and you're politician B, and I don't like politician A, but I do like politician B, I can control who gets to go where, which is essentially, I get to control what those people are going to do, which is obviously a massive overreach of corporate power. Now, in what some would call a strange twist of fate, and what I would call historically predictable, having read Carol Quigley's Evolution of Civilizations, in 1889, the American populace in general was repeatedly finding their natural rights being trodden on in the name of natural rights. How does that make any sense? It makes sense through one of the sacred tenets of natural rights, which is the contract, that two free persons or two free organizations, or a person in an organization, are free to enter into whatever kind of contract they want to, as long as it doesn't infringe on the rights of somebody else. So this is great philosophy until one of those parties in the contract runs into a situation where they're so desperate that they'll literally do anything to get into that contract. For example, let's say I desperately need a job, and the employer says, okay, before I give you this job, you need to waive your right to sue me in case you get injured on the job. Well, if I'm doing incredibly dangerous work, that's a hard call to say that I'm living as a free human being if that is the agreement that I've had to enter into in order to sustain myself. So one of the things that the Washington framers did is they explicitly added into the Washington State Constitution that the legislature was allowed to create laws to protect and create safety requirements for industrial workers. Now, leaving aside what that has turned into modern day with labor and industries. This was important at the time, again, 1889, because legislation that was being attempted like this, creating safety requirements in states back east, were constantly getting thrown out of court because the judicial ruling was that this violated the right of contract between the employee and the employer. Now, if this challenge to the sacred right of contract is hard to swallow and conceptualize, especially to anyone with a libertarian background, I totally understand. We're really hitting a rift here where things get tense when we're talking about natural rights and how to produce a free society. Now, I want to emphasize this because I've changed my mind recently on this, and it's really important to point this out because I've garnered this from historical research, is that outside of outright conquest in war, the main method of acquiring slaves for an individual or for a specific culture throughout human history and across all cultures was to get a person into a desperate situation that they would agree to terms that would eventually lead them to a debt that they could never repay, thus becoming indentured servants at best or slaves at worst. Now, clearly that concept or that situation is repugnant to the idea of freedom, and clearly would be a concern to a worker in 1889 industrial America, where, you know, you're looking at the situation where I could either starve by not getting a job or go to work and die in this incredibly dangerous factory. Clearly conditions could be better than that. So the Washington State framers were really wrestling with these conflicting ideas, because I really don't want to suggest that they were just throwing natural rights out the window saying we got to protect people from corporations, because they were also incredibly concerned about chasing those corporations away. They said, we need business here. It's really important that business wants to come here and develop the state and encourage people to move here. So the agreement that they reached, and this is fascinating, is that they forewent the language of natural rights and instead replaced it with individual rights in attempt to eliminate this issue of corporations using the concept of natural rights, and particularly the tenet of the sacred right of contract, to abuse the rights of individuals. And in enshrining the protections of those individual rights, the Washington State Constitution almost never mentions just whom these rights are being protected against. So as I said about the American Constitution, where typically the language is, Congress shall pass no law abridging the freedom of speech abridging the right to bear arms. In the Washington State Constitution, it says the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have it in front of my face. The right to free speech shall not be impaired. It never says from who, and this is on purpose, because the idea that the Washington State framers had is they said, we don't care who is infringing the rights, whether it's government or private, it's not allowed. It's unconstitutional. So what are the ramifications of this? I'm going to argue that the ramifications are that this language, this hair splitting between natural and individual rights, is very relevant to the situation today. As we've seen, the king, formerly known as Governor Jay Inslee, has been going on a business killing spree with his lockdowns and mask mandates and these phases that keep sliding back and forth, where none of these rules make any sense. And all that he seems to be doing is leaving this body trail of businesses in his wake. What he's doing is he's getting around the constitutionality issue of his mandates by getting labor and industries to threaten private business to enforce his stuff for him. This is as clever as it is evil, and here's why. Because when the state goes after the populace in the United States, we tend to go all 1776 and get our feathers bristled and say, you're infringing on my rights, which is good. That's what we're supposed to do. However, if a private business does it, we tend to fall back on this natural rights conundrum that I've brought up, where we say, okay, well, there's this sacred contract, and the private business is allowed to do whatever they want because they're a private business, right? So if I go in and I say, hey, I'm not going to wear a mask because it's my constitutional right that I don't have to put something on my face. It's a right of expression. It's a right of speech. It's a right of whatever. The business can say, that's great. I don't care about any of that. I personally don't want you here. You're trespassing. Get out. Now, that's what the right of the business is, right? They're allowed to do that. Or are they? That's the question I want to bring up. Or are they? This is where I want to reinvigorate the discussion that our state framers had in Olympia on July 4th, 1889. The Washington State Constitution protects individual rights from both government and private institutions. And even the king, Jay Inslee, said on the eve of his first proclamation of mask mandate in Yakima, if you haven't seen this video, go watch it, he openly states, hey, the reason I'm not wearing a mask is because I have a First Amendment right not to do so. Now, if the First Amendment is relevant here, or Article 1, Section 5 for the Washington State equivalent of freedom of speech, do private institutions in Washington State truly have the authority to force us to do things such as wear a shame mask or stay 6 feet away from everybody else, or, you know, you got to go down this aisle this way and you got to go down the other aisle that way just so we can engage in day-to-day lawful business such as grocery shopping or going out to eat? I don't think so. And I don't think the Washington framers thought so either. I'm saying it's time we've had another discussion on individual rights as the Washington State framers conceptualize them that we have as citizens in Washington State. Do the governor and the state as a whole have the authority to limit our freedom to not cover our faces in shame when we go out in public?
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watching on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Now, just so you guys know, Washington State today actually filed a writ of mandamus against the governor. So again, once again, we saw Idaho and how they win. We saw Washington and how they win. Pretty awesome, isn't it? I think it's pretty awesome. But you know what? Illinois filed a writ of mandamus against their governor too. But what I found was that did you know that the Illinois state constitution was written in 1970? And it's supposed to have gotten an update. Did you guys know that? That they're changing the Illinois constitution. And that is crazy. I think it's important you guys watch this video and listen to what this guy has to say about that. It's mind-boggling.
1969. Men were walking on the moon. Richard Nixon was in the White House. And Illinois was over $1 billion in debt and desperate to get out of it. Some things never change. Between 1968 and 1970, Illinois lawmakers convened in the 6th Illinois Constitutional Convention, the result of which would be the Illinois Constitution that we have today. One of the key changes in this new constitution was the introduction of the state's flat income tax, which at the time was seen as a sort of grand bargain between Republicans, led by Governor Richard Ogilvie, and Democrats, led by Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. Everyone had high hopes that this would put the state back on the path towards fiscal responsibility. Spoiler alert, it didn't work. We have doubled the flat income tax since it first came out, and the state is still broke, which has left communities around the state raising property taxes to try to cover the holes in their budgets. All in all, we've wound up with a tax system that disproportionately relies on the wealth of middle and working class families for revenue, which just doesn't work. Okay, so where do we go from here? Well, there's finally momentum to switch the state to a graduated income tax system, which is what the vast majority of other states in the country use. But that requires changing the Constitution, which is really hard. There's basically two ways you can go about it. First, we could call another constitutional convention, the 7th Illinois Constitutional Convention, which would be great if you wanted to start from scratch. And there are some people who are advocating for this, especially people who want to change the way the state handles pension obligations. But let's be real, that would take forever. It would be a massive undertaking, and there's no real guarantee at what we'd get at the end of it. Instead, Democrats are moving forward with a constitutional amendment. Amending the state's constitution is intentionally difficult. First, somebody introduces the amendment, and then it needs to pass through both the House and Senate with supermajorities. Right now, Democrats actually have that. The last election was a windfall for Democrats across the state, so for once, no problem there, assuming that they can stay unified against what will probably be some fierce opposition. But then the amendment needs what is sometimes called a supermajority of voters in the next general election. It either needs 51% of the total people voting on that ballot supporting it, which is harder than it sounds because this is one of those questions at the end of a very long ballot, or it needs 3/5 of all the people who just vote on that one question. And that's where other states trying to make the switch have run into problems. In Colorado, one of the only other 8 states that still uses a flat income tax, it made it all the way through this process, but was voted down at the finish line. In part, due to campaigns by anti-tax advocates around the state and around the country. And that's why I'm thinking of Colorado as our ghost of election future. Very soon, we are going to start seeing ads for and against the graduated tax switch. And I would really like bonus points if those ads are in black and white with scary red text and
a concerned woman's voice.
So, if you're already sick of hearing me talk about this, I've got terrible news. It'll be another year and 8 months of this. But at the end of this arduous process, we could pull off what politicians 50 years ago couldn't, which is building a tax system that addresses the needs of today while being flexible enough to last for the future.
And as I said, the state of Illinois today had their writ of mandamus filed in the Supreme Court as well. How fantastic. Now let's go and learn about the Ohio Constitution quickly. See, your state constitution tells you a lot. The reason I brought up the Chicago, I keep saying Chicago, because damn, Chicago is the only one that's taking all of Illinois' money. And with Beetlejuice at the head, damn, she's like a vampire. Kind of looks like one too. Illinois is the only state that if you win the lottery, you get a fucking IOU on a piece of paper. I am hoping that, and I'm so glad, I spoke of Clarence Thomas. I don't know if I did it on air, but I spoke to many saying, I'm actually quite excited with my case. I think I did say it on air because it'll go to the 6th District and then Clarence Thomas will be overseeing my Supreme Court. It's his jurisdiction, okay? And so we're going to talk about him today because he came out and said exactly what I said, that no justice, well, I'll let you hear him after we go through this, but I've said this many, many times before when people were talking, Amy Coney Barrett is so bad. Oh, this is so bad. Remember, a justice never says anything just to say it, okay? They never say things just to say things. And actually, someone quoted me on that and shared the same thing that I had teed up to watch today, which is incredible because that means we're all vibing on the same frequency. We totally understand it. What they are doing is exercising arbitrary power, and all we're going to do is keep fighting them until they bend the knee to the Constitution to uphold the oath that they took. That is what is most important right now, that they need to uphold their oaths and they're not doing it. They're allowing corporations to take the reins of our government and guide our society into the way they want us to be. I told you it was very dangerous what Biden said. He said, well, employers should be able to protect themselves. Well, employers will mandate that everyone has a vaccine because they own you. What? You need to put that shit in your body before I accept you. And then when all the sheep have filled the slots, they will say, I'm sorry, you're not vaccinated. You may not enter. Now you're seeing how real that looks. I mean, in Canada, it already started. But let's take a look at the Ohio Constitution now. That's kind of cool. This came from Attorney General DeWine. This is before he became governor. You know, all corrupt states always have attorney generals becoming governors. It's the most insane thing I've ever seen. This state is so filled with nepotism. I've never seen something like that before across America. Like, I thought Boston was bad with all the Goddards. Shit. This is crazy.
Capital of Columbus. The State House is home to the Ohio House of Representatives and the Ohio Senate, which together comprise the General Assembly, Ohio's legislative branch. Behind me, you'll find the Historical Museum, which includes the Ohio Constitution exhibit. This is a perfect setting to allow us to talk about Ohio's Constitution, or should I say constitutions? Hold that thought. Come on in. First, let's talk about the events that led up to the formation of Ohio's first Constitution, the 1802 Constitution. Ohio was originally part of the Northwest Territory, established in 1787. Today, the lands of the former Northwest Territory hold 6 different states: Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin, as well as part of Minnesota. The first step towards statehood was the Enabling Act of 1802, which authorized the residents of modern-day Ohio to begin the process of becoming a state. In the early months of 1803, when the first Ohio Constitution was signed on this table, Ohio became the 17th state to join the Union. But let's dig a little deeper into what drove the framework behind Ohio's first constitution. There was a real concern among delegates to Ohio's first constitutional convention when drafting the 1802 Constitution. They felt that too much power had been given to the governor of the Northwest Territory. So the 1802 Constitution, like the federal model, called for three branches of government. But rather than equal powers, the legislative branch was given the most powers. For example, the legislature appointed key judicial and executive officers, including the attorney general. Under the 1802 Constitution, the governor was the only executive official elected by a statewide popular vote. Edward Tiffin was Ohio's first governor. But again, because Ohioans resented the extensive powers of the governor of the Northwest Territory, Ohio's governor had very little power, and that resulted in a weak governor's office. The Constitution of 1802 also required the Supreme Court of Ohio to meet in each and every county in the state. In 1803, there were only 17 counties, but by 1851, Ohio reached its current level of 88 counties. That's a lot of counties and a lot of miles to cover. This constitutional requirement overextended the judicial system and became unmanageable as the number of counties rapidly grew. Because so much power was consolidated in the General Assembly, there were many accusations of corruption. For example, the state debt exploded during the early 1800s because the General Assembly funded private companies. With a strong but corrupt legislature, a weak executive, and an exhausted judiciary, it took less than a half century to realize that change was needed. And that change came in 1851. Unlike many states and the federal constitution, Ohio's constitution allows for a constitutional convention every 20 years. In 1850, voters elected to have that constitutional convention. And although we haven't had a convention since 1912, every 20 years, voters still have the opportunity to call for a convention. The new 1851 Constitution balanced the power among the three branches of government.
The redrafting in 1851 kept the same basic structure with the three branches of government, but it made several changes that I think made our government more efficient and more effective. The 1851 changes also made some restrictions on the debt that the state could incur. There were some restrictions placed on taxes. We didn't have a poll tax anymore. That meant you didn't have to pay a tax to go vote. That change didn't come about in other states until much later than 1851. And finally, for the judicial system, it was really a significant change. Most significantly for us in the judiciary was the creation of intermediate appellate courts. So to have that intermediate level of appellate review was really significant, both in terms of reducing a burden on the judicial, on the justices of the Ohio Supreme Court, but also in terms of getting an additional layer of review for the people of Ohio.
The change to elect statewide office holders was drastic, but it created the system that we have today for electing our office holders. For example, the Ohio Attorney General's office was created in 1846, and at that time, the Attorney General was appointed directly by the General Assembly and not by the voters of Ohio. All of this changed with the constitutional changes in 1851. There, the Attorney General became a statewide office holder, and citizens of the state of Ohio were given the opportunity to directly elect him or her to office. While the original duties of the Ohio Attorney General were not as expansive as they are today, the 1851 Constitution certainly laid the groundwork for today's Attorney General's office.
Compared to the 1802 Constitution, the 1851 Constitution had much more similarities with the United States Constitution, even though the Ohio Constitution was far lengthier. Ohio's Constitution contains over 36,000 words compared to the federal Constitution of only 9,000 words. The Attorney General's office has the duty of enforcing all 36,000 of these words. So, if the Constitution is questioned, the Attorney General's office helps defend it. Many of these cases are before the Supreme Court of Ohio. The Supreme Court is the final judicial authority on the Ohio Constitution. For example, in 2001, the Ohio Attorney General's office defended the constitutionality of the state motto, "With God, all things are possible." The Supreme Court of Ohio, as the final judicial authority of the Ohio Constitution, found that the motto did not violate the First Amendment of both the federal and state constitutions.
The United States Constitution and the Ohio Constitution create three branches of government and put in place some checks and balances among those three branches. So in that way, the two constitutions are very much the same. But there are some significant differences. The Ohio Constitution is pretty easy, comparatively, pretty easy to amend. The United States Constitution has only been amended 27 times. We only have 27 amendments to the United States Constitution. The Ohio Constitution has been amended more than 150 times. So when you think in terms of weight and density, the Ohio Constitution is much more specific to our needs and what the citizens of Ohio really want. Well, the first principle to remember is that the United States Constitution provides that it and all laws of the United States are the supreme law of the land. But I think the best way to really think about the interaction between the Ohio Constitution and the United States Constitution is to think of the United States Constitution as the floor. Those provisions in the United States Constitution give us our basic rights and privileges as U.S. citizens. Now, a state can go above the rights and privileges that are provided in the United States Constitution, but we can't go below. And that's not an old issue. That's something that we deal with right up until today.
I hope you now have a better understanding about the history of Ohio's two constitutions. And remember those dates the next time you're playing trivia, 1802 and 1851.
Okay, no one was listening to me because I forgot that I muted myself. Because for some reason it's echoing, which means my setup is all wrong today. So what I was going to say is it's ironic that Governor DeWine was that AG DeWine you saw in the video, supposedly ready to enforce and defend the Ohio State Constitution, when it's blatant and in plain English that he's been violating it. It's just so sad. So now let's move on to Arizona. Arizona has a meaty constitution, but I thought it was important for us to look at how Arizona's constitution is amended. Why amendments? Well, you're going to see the panic soon. So let's start on that. Okay, let's get on that.
This election in Arizona, there are three constitutional amendments voters get to decide on. Prop 125, 126, and 127. Each one has a different and varied effect on the state, but all share a common path to how they've reached voters this year. The journey from idea to ballot proposition to amendment in the state constitution is an interesting one and might be less difficult than some might imagine. So what goes into changing the Arizona Constitution? Arizona held its first constitutional convention in 1910 when the state was still a territory. The first draft of what would become the state's constitution was signed by the delegates at the convention on December 9, 1910. It was originally vetoed by President William Howard Taft, who objected to a provision allowed voters to recall judges. After another constitutional convention, President Taft approved Arizona statehood in February 1912. 9 months later, Arizona voters approved amending the state constitution for the first time and added back the provision on recalling judges. Arizona's constitution has been amended an additional 151 times since. 1980 wins for the most constitutional amendments on the ballot in 1 year, with 17 on the ballot and 13 of them passing. But how does an amendment end up on the ballot? There are three methods. A petition by voters in the state can get an amendment referred to the ballot, but it needs to be signed by 15% of the total number of votes cast for governor in the most recent election. For example, if 1 million people voted for governor last election, you need 150,000 signatures. In 2014, there were 1,506,416 votes for governor. That means all three constitutional amendments on this year's ballot had to get signatures from at least 225,963 Arizona voters. The second way is for the state legislature to refer a constitutional amendment to the ballot, which only requires a simple majority vote in both chambers. Lastly, a constitutional convention may be called by a statewide vote and cannot be called into effect by the legislature. Any proposed changes at the convention would still have to go to the ballot. Now say an amendment goes to the ballot and voters and politicians end up regretting their decision. Well, there are a few remedies. If it's found to be in conflict with the U.S. Constitution, the federal courts are likely to step in. Voters can also get signatures to create another amendment or to amend the amendment. The legislature can use its authority to do the same. Constitutional amendments are a way for Arizona to stay on top of our changing democracy and are a way for residents to change how its government operates. They'll likely continue to be a major part of every Arizona election.
I'm Jerry McDonald Evoy with the Arizona Mirror, and if you want to learn more about Arizona elections, make sure to like and follow the Arizona Mirror.
It was kind of hysterical, the whole video, but it was important for you guys to see it and understand it. We'll listen to it more than anything, because they're telling you how you amend the Constitution. That's what's important, okay? That is what is important, how they strike down things, how they change things. Arizona, remember this, because this is going to be coming up to you guys first. I mean, because, you know, next week is going to be a little bit of a potty. So it's really, really important that we focus. Next week is going to be fire. So Arizona, you got to have your pulse on your legislators, because these people go rogue and you can't even tell. So remember the word prop.
Hi, I'm Ophelia Jacobson with Campus Reform. Friday is Constitution Day, so we're talking to students at the University of Florida to get an idea of what their opinion is of the Constitution. Is it outdated? Do they think we need a brand new Constitution? Plus, will students go so far as to sign a petition to completely abolish the U.S. Constitution? Let's find out. So Constitution Day is on September 17th. What do you guys think of the Constitution?
Absolute terrible. Needs to be redone immediately.
I think it needs a lot more reform for the changes that have happened since then. I think a lot of the things in there, they do need to be like reevaluated, I guess.
I think we just need to update it on like more equality, equity, stuff like that.
Okay, so the Constitution, I feel like it's outdated, like some of the stuff on there.
I think that our Constitution that we have for America is to some degree outdated, but I also think it is very historical.
You can't put a price on how valuable the Constitution is. I think when you look at us versus other countries throughout time, you know, no matter, you know, the press and trials that we face, the absolute, you know, security of our freedoms in the Constitution is what has kept this country together and kept us great through thick and thin.
Do you think the Constitution is outdated?
I mean, I think it has to be. It was written in the late 1700s. It wasn't written for the 21st century.
Extremely. It's completely outdated. It was written by those that don't represent the both of us at the moment, and it didn't represent everybody at the time.
Yes.
Yes, a tad.
There are a lot of outdated things in there that nowadays aren't accepted.
To an extent, like when people talk about the Second Amendment and like the right to bear arms.
Not all of it's necessarily the easiest applied to now.
Do you think that the Constitution is a portrayal of the patriarchy since it was created by the founding fathers?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I would definitely say so, especially since when you reflect back on those who were writing it at the time and you see it's all old white men.
I mean, I think it's impossible not to. I mean, they didn't have another perspective, nor were they seeking it.
Absolutely, yes, I think so.
It should have been made by like a group of diverse people, but back then, you know how I was back then.
Yeah, I do. And I agree with her. Like, it should be revised by different people.
The time period, you know, was rich old white men. And that's exactly what that document says and stands for and vouches for.
I mean, just because words were written by men doesn't make it part of the patriarchy. I mean, if it were written by women, it wouldn't be the matriarchy.
I'm going around with this petition. As you can see, I've already gotten some of your fellow students to sign a petition to abolish the Constitution, create a whole new one, to be more inclusive, you know, more politically aware of our surroundings in 2021. Would you guys be willing to sign this petition?
Yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And would you be willing to sign that?
Sure.
It should be abolished. Like, it's time for a new Constitution. It wasn't like pronouns like they, them, stuff like that either.
So we should include the new pronouns in the Constitution?
Yeah, like to make everyone feel included.
The issues of social and cultural differences within our country have been such an issue, you know, predicated by the control that the federal government has over everything. And the federal government is governed by the Constitution. And
so you would say that the Constitution is the root of our issues in this country?
Stop! Did you guys hear me? Could you hear me when I muted myself? I was screaming, stop. Stop, 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 stop. Pronouns in the fucking Constitution. I feel like I wanted to take both their heads and knock them together. Hopefully, you know, some information transfer. Maybe they could share a brain, because it sounded completely, damn it. Like, and this one right here, that's talking, the one that's talking, like, that chick, You put cuffs on her, she'll start crying. I have rights. I'm sorry, you've abolished the Constitution. But I have rights. You've abolished the Constitution. Like, these people are just so dumb. So freaking dumb.
I mean, it's one of them. You could also lead it back to capitalism.
I would have to look into it, so I'm not going to make on, like, a decision on something I don't really know that well, that much about. In the future, if it comes a time that we need to, then I think we should.
Like, someone can, like, come up with one that's better. Then sure, why not? Like, why not give it a try?
I would like to see a document, you know, in the future to be put together by a more diverse group of people.
I think that is a very naive idea. I think a lot of people who, you know, see, you know, surface level problems tend to think.
Mr. Mackey right here, who's like, okay, okay. He's the only one that makes sense, even though he's still fruity.
You know, maybe they just tear everything down. They don't realize that the Constitution and its guarantees have actually kept a lot of problems from happening.
Out of all those students, only one made sense, and he sounded like Mr. Mackey from South Park. Okay. But he made 100% sense. You know what I would have loved to say? Hey, can you tell me what the 9th Amendment is, or the 10th one? How about the 4th one? Maybe the 5th one? That's the easy one. I'm sure all of you, when you protest and shit to kill babies, know that one. Oh, it's so, so, so saddening that people don't know their Constitution. Even, you know, you guys. How many of you have actually read your state's Constitution? Not all of you. I'm pretty sure less than 30% of you did. Well, until now. And that's the thing. Until we get some fire under our ass and realize that freedom isn't free, right? You got to work for it. And we haven't been working for our communities for a very long time. We've just been busy with life. And since time is so expensive and you work so hard, the only thing you want to do when you have time is to do absolutely fuck all and watch HGTV, flipping houses, backsplashes, you know, maybe go to a football game, maybe, you know, tailgate for like a day, go fishing, right? You don't want to be involved. Yet, if you remember the video that was banned that I had done, I'm going to upload it on Rumble, but I did a new version of If I Were the Devil as If I Were Obama. I don't know if you guys remember that one, but it's really important to understand that back in the day, a person would be working from morning to evening. They'd have their supper and then they'd go to the school board meeting. They would volunteer as, you know, firefighters. They would be at city council meetings. Like, how many of you honestly have been to one city council meeting? Just one that didn't involve you. Okay. If it was about your property and shit, you probably went. I guarantee you it's less than 10% of you listening right now. We haven't been participating in our community, so we can't bitch about it failing. But what we can do is take it back and say, all right, all right, all right, all right. I was asleep. I'm taking over. It's like when you're in that mood, that depression mode where you're like, fuck cleaning, and you've got pizza boxes everywhere, clothes on the floor trailing around, empty boxes, garbage on the counter. And you're like, oh, and then it comes to a point and you're like, fuck it. I just got to do this because I didn't keep on top of it. Well, this is the mess that we need to clean up. And the only way to clean it up is by taking it by the reins and saying, stop, stop, stop. I'm here. I was sleeping. Look, got the whole sleep out of my eye. I'm here. I'm present. And this is not fucking happening. Okay. I messed up. I was sleeping all this time. I am now awake and I am taking my nation back. That's exactly what we have to do. Now, listen to what Justice Thomas said.
And Biden is blasting the Supreme.
If it wants to play, give me a second. Let me get this volume going, and here we go.
Court decision allowing Texas's new abortion law to take effect. It is the strictest law in the nation and leaves women seeking abortions with few options. CBS's Ben Tracy is at the Supreme Court.
The blockbuster decision from a sharply divided Supreme Court effectively allows almost all abortions to be banned in the state of Texas, affecting millions of women. 5 of the conservative justices allow the law to stand despite acknowledging there are serious questions regarding its constitutionality. Anti-abortion advocates declared victory.
With this bill, we do hope to see an end to abortion.
Chief Justice John Roberts sided with the 3 liberal justices. In a blistering dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor called her colleague's decision stunning and the Texas law flagrantly unconstitutional. This clinic in Fort Worth is nearly empty today, forced to turn away patients or send them across state lines.
Most of them this morning told us it's not about the finances of getting to another state. It's the days off of work. It's finding someone to take care of their children and their families, and it's impossible.
The Texas law bans abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy, when a so-called fetal heartbeat is detected, a controversial term because of how undeveloped the embryo is at that stage. The law makes no exception for rape or incest. Texas Right to Life is now encouraging people to provide tips about anyone trying to break the new law, and clinics in Oklahoma and Kansas say they are now seeing patients arrive from Texas. President Biden slammed the high court's decision not to intervene, calling it an unprecedented assault on a woman's constitutional rights under Roe v. Wade, and directed federal agencies, including the Justice Department, to try to ensure women in Texas have access to abortion.
And Ben Tracy joins us now. So, Ben, this Texas law used a novel legal approach by deputizing citizens to enforce it. The justices noted that, right?
Again, you didn't hear me. What I said is they're upset that they're deputizing citizens like the Karens that are enforcing the mask mandates, the contact tracing, you know, the you need to get your vaccine. They don't like the Karens. They don't like it when the shoe's on the other foot about saving lives. Let me tell you something. Abortion is illegal in Texas. But let's take it this way. You're in Texas and you're pregnant. And the doctor says, look, you're 9 weeks along. But if you don't terminate this pregnancy, you're going to die. And I know it's illegal, but this is a healthcare thing, right? Your life is an immediate threat. Guess what? That abortion is happening, right? Because you'll be able to have more children, but this is happening. Now, for me personally, I'd be like, no, it's not happening. Other people have that choice. Younger people that can't have babies later where, you know, a doctor might say, listen, you're pregnant like this, or topics, for example, or a baby that hasn't sat right within the uterus. This happens. It can bust your uterus. So not only will you lose the baby later, or if you actually go full term, you have the baby, you will never have babies again. So there are exceptions to that. Okay. It's not about, you know, oh, you know what? I slept with this dude, the condom broke, and I got pregnant. Tough shit. I got raped. Still a baby. Still a baby. It's not the baby's fault. But when you are pregnant and there is a life-threatening situation and you will die, which can be determined. Some people, you know how women, when they give birth in the olden times, they bled to death and stuff. This is the type of stuff that I'm talking about, right? The things that we can detect. But you can't have elective abortions like, oh, this baby may have Down syndrome. I'm terminating it. You won't be able to do that. No selections. So I think that's fair. I think it's fair. When it comes down to your health, I think it's fair. I mean, speaking from experience being pregnant and having an inability to have children, I was told I knew I couldn't have children. So the first time I got pregnant, it was like, it was crazy. I didn't even know till I was 16 weeks along. And they were twins and I still look hot. I mean, eating Häagen-Dazs Belgium chocolate with a pickle should have been a giveaway, but you know, I do have a strange palate, so I didn't even think about it. But I was just shocked. Someone that's never had a menstrual cycle, you know, properly, right? Not able to, you know, I was told, no, you're not having kids. And I was okay with it. To get pregnant, it was a miracle. And then after that, I was like, oh, shit, I want a whole football team. The doors just open. And I couldn't have any. And then I had Phoebe, which was totally weird, too. It's like, it was really weird, like how I got pregnant with her. It was just odd. there would be no way. I knew there was a risk, right? Not because I was old or shriveled or anything like that, but because I knew that I wasn't supposed to have kids. I wasn't supposed to have children. So there was always that risk. And when they would be like, well, let's do a genetic screen, I'd be like, no, I just don't want to know. I'm going to have whatever God gives me, but I'm going to imagine this. I'm going to do the best I can. You know, the minute I found out I was pregnant, smoking stopped immediately. The minute the water broke, though, cigarette was straight into the mouth. So, you know, it was something different for me. But the thoughts did creep through my mind. Well, what if? Do I really want a child that's going to, you know, be hindered? And then when I die, they're going to be by themselves. You know, these are the things that mothers think about when things like that happen, right? And I totally get it. But life is life. You don't have the choice to do it. You don't have the choice. But let's listen to what else is said here.
That's right, Nora. This Texas law actually encourages private citizens to sue anybody who provides or helps a woman get one of these now banned abortions. And if they win one of those lawsuits, they're entitled to at least $10,000. In his dissent, Chief Justice John Roberts said, it's not only unusual, it's unprecedented.
Ben Tracy, thank you.
I don't want to advertise. It's not here where Clarence Thomas made a speech. Where is it? I'll read it to you. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas on Thursday criticized, listen to this, some in the judiciary for veering into the role of legislators and politician, saying it's not fair for judges to make policy or to base decisions on their personal feelings or religious beliefs. In an address to the University of Notre Dame, the longest serving justice in part blamed judges who are venturing into areas we should not have entered to for contentiousness in the nomination process, particularly in the nominations of federal judges who receive lifetime appointments. The court was thought to be the least dangerous branch, and we may have become the most dangerous. And I think that's problematic. You know what I like? That Justice Clarence Thomas actually says exactly what we've been saying on this show for forever. There's a legislative, there's an executive, and there's a judiciary branch. If your legislative is corrupt, you can survive. If your executive branch is corrupt, you can survive. If both executive and legislative are corrupt, you can still survive. But if your judicial branch is corrupt, you're fucked. And this is exactly what we're seeing. So that is quite important. Now, having said that, we're going to take a break. But to take a break, I'm going to play for you a snippet of pretty much, I just put like a cover thing that's not really good on the front to show you what my documentary is. So I'm going to play a song and then we're going to come back and I'm going to introduce you to that before we get into more Constitution stuff. I'll see you all in just a bit.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros. Two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude. Stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Just to live these days. It's hard to play the hand that was down to me. The past I'm running from won't set me free. I don't think I'll ever change these ways.
And we can't let that happen, because that's a stain on our country that's worse than any stain we've ever had before. It's an embarrassment. Biden didn't even speak today. He went to all three places. And he didn't speak. I wonder why. I wonder why he didn't speak. No, think of it.
No teleprompter.
He went. No teleprompter. He went. No, he went to three places. All three places. He went to the Pentagon. Went to Pennsylvania. He came here, and he didn't speak.
He can't finish the sentence.
Ah, what a shame.
I'm pretty sure I didn't know.
The election was rigged, and that's what we got. That's what we got. Listen, I want to thank everybody. You are incredible people. We love you. We always will. And a lot of things interesting happening. They are, you know, they're only good at doing bad things, in my opinion. If they fought the war the way they fought the election, where they stole it, I don't even say stole it, they rigged it.
Yes.
We would have had, this war would have been over 20 years ago. You wouldn't have had a war. You would have had the thing, they would have been apologizing 20 years ago. But they didn't do that. They don't do that. They only do bad stuff. You wonder whether or not they love our country. I love you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
This one has to be good. Thank you. I am here as your president to proclaim before the country and before the world, this monument will never be desecrated. These heroes will never be defaced. Their legacy will never, ever be destroyed. Their achievements will never be forgotten. And Mount Rushmore will stand forever as an eternal tribute to our forefathers and to our freedom. We are the nation that gave rise to the Wright brothers, Harriet Tubman, George Patton, the great Louis Armstrong, Elvis Presley, Ella Fitzgerald. We settled the Wild West, won two world wars, landed American astronauts on the moon. Centuries from now, our legacy will be the cities we built, the champions we forged, the good that we did, and the monuments we created. America's destiny is in our sights. America's heroes are embedded in our hearts. America's future is in our hands. And ladies and gentlemen, the best is yet to come.
This is a movement, I'm telling you. They're not going to stop, and they should not.
These people are tearing up our livelihood.
A third straight night, Portland police declared a riot.
The vast majority of the protests have been peaceful.
Over the weekend, 59 officers injured and 47 people arrested.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announcing a proposal to cut $1 billion from the New York City Police Department.
We need to completely dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department.
Welcome, everyone, to the Tori Says Show. I'm your host, Tori. I am trying to give you a little snippet. It's just thrown together. It's not really done properly. It's just a snippet for you guys to see. So I'm hoping that you guys like it. It's a little snippet. Let's see. I'm trying to get this to work and it hasn't been wanting to work. So I apologize for that. All right, here we go. Let's see. All right, this is it. And I cannot play it. That's fantastic. All right, since I can't play it, we're going to start with a constitutional video until I figure it out, since it doesn't want to be my friend. It's obviously not in the correct format to play, so give me a second while I get that done. I could have sworn it was all fine and dandy, but we're going to go back in time to those times that we were kids and learned about the Constitution.
Do you know about the USA? Do you know about the government? Can you tell me about the Constitution? Hey, learn about the USA. In 1787, I'm told, our founding fathers did agree to write a list of principles for keeping people free. The USA was just starting out, a whole brand new country. And so our people spelled it out, the things that we should be. And they put those principles down on paper and called it the Constitution. And it's been helping us run our country ever since then. The
first part of the Constitution is called the Preamble and tells what those founding fathers set out to do.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare at hand, secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. In 1787, I'm told, our founding fathers all sat down and wrote a list of principles that's known the world around. The USA was just starting out a whole brand new country, and so our people spelled it out. They wanted a land of liberty. And the preamble goes like this. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare at hand, secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America, for the United States of America.
Okay, so that was Schoolhouse Rock with, the U.S. Constitution. Something was brought to my attention yesterday that I had talked about with friends a long, long time ago when I wanted to start an investigation into the Bank of North Dakota. And this was in 2009 when I noticed some dubious transactions. And I had raised some flags within a few agencies. And there were discussions ensuing. And the discussions that ensued was that this bank was operating as the bank of the state of North Dakota, but the state of North Dakota wasn't really a state. What? Yeah. And someone brought that up, and I thought, whoa, maybe it's time to talk about it. Take a listen.
SKL was made possible by Skillshare. Start learning new skills for free for 2 months at skl.sh/hai28. North Dakota is the type of place most people don't know much about. If you were to ask a random person on the street to name a fact about North Dakota, they'd probably say to you, hey man, it's really weird that you came up to me on the street and demand that I tell you a fact about North Dakota. If you really push them, the best answer they'd be likely, for example, until recently, it may not have been a state at all. And why? We have to first look at Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, which says, the members of several state legislators and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. While that might be less readable than Moby Dick, what that section means is actually pretty simple. State officers from all three branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial, have to take an oath that they will support the U.S. Constitution. But here's the problem. Until recently, the North Dakota State Constitution didn't require its executive officers, like the governor, to take an oath of office. That may seem like a minor issue, but if there's one thing autocorrect has taught us, it's that small mistakes can have a big impact. Because of that omission, some experts agree that North Dakota didn't actually meet the qualifications for statehood, which means that, until the state constitution was fixed, it was never actually a state. Now, to be clear, not everyone agrees with that argument. After all, when it comes to the U.S. Constitution, getting everyone to agree is kind of like trying to have a nuanced debate in a YouTube comment section. It's scientifically impossible. Some constitutional scholars agree that while North Dakota's state constitution did violate Article 6, that doesn't mean it wasn't a state, as violating Article 6 doesn't affect Congress's power to admit states to the Union, which is laid out in Article 4, which says, new states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of state without the consent of the legislators of the state concerned, as well as of the Congress. That section gives Congress the power to make new states and says not to put a state inside of another state or to combine or separate states without their permission. If only the British and French believed in this whole not dividing pre-existing states thing when they took out the Creoles and drew a bunch of arbitrary borders around the Middle East, leading to much of the ethnic and geopolitical conflicts of today. Those aforementioned restrictions are the only ones on Congress's state-making power, except, of course, for the unofficial rule of no shirt, no shoes, too many Democrats, not enough swing votes, no statehood. Damn, who would have thought this politics-related video would get so political? Given that Congress's power to make states is so broad, the question is, because Congress said North Dakota is a state, does that mean it is a state regardless of whether or not it violated the Constitution? Normally, the answer would likely be yes, it's still a state. After all, states violate the US Constitution sort of all the time. When they do, there's a lawsuit and it gets taken to the courts. For example, if Texas amended their state constitution to require everyone to always root for the Dallas Cowboys, that would violate freedom of expression and thus the US Constitution, and the Supreme Court would strike it down, but that would just mean that the people in Texas don't have to cheer for the Cowboys, not that Texas wasn't a state. In other words, the argument goes, the issue of statehood and constitutional compliance are separate. But here's where things get tricky. North Dakota's statehood issue doesn't stop with Article 6. See, the original law that made North Dakota a state was something called the Enabling Act of 1889, and Section 4 of that act declared that in order to become a state, North Dakota must make a state constitution, which they did, but also that, quote, the state constitution shall not be repugnant to the Constitution of the United States, which is where we run into problems. That's because, by violating Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, one could argue that the North Dakota state constitution was, in fact, repugnant to the Constitution of the United States. It just depends on your definition of repugnant. Something I might call repugnant, other people might call Taco Bell. But if we believe that violating Article 6 is sufficiently repugnant, that would mean that not only did North Dakota violate Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, but by doing so, it also failed to meet the qualifications for statehood set out by the Enabling Act of 1889, which was supposed to make it a state, and because of that, its statehood has always been illegitimate. Ultimately, the issue is now moot. A North Dakota historian named John Rolsinski noticed the problem in 1995 and spent the next 17 years lobbying the state legislator, or I suppose what was then the territorial legislator, to fix it. Eventually, in 2011, a North Dakota legislator took up his cause and got a constitutional amendment put on the ballot. Which
like they should be fighting these issues because they're moot. It's way too hard. Why would we do this? Why would I sit there and, you know, find myself in a predicament where people are upset with me, no one's happy with me, they're all upset. Like, how am I going to deal with it? Well, I'll tell you how I forced the legislation to do it. When I wanted to open up an investigation into the Bank of North Dakota for illegitimately operating as a state bank without any rights to do so, it kind of opened the door for me to be able to penetrate the higher ranks. And this is how things such as human trafficking and dirty deals under the table were done. It was so easy to look at because I had free rein only because I was investigating the legitimacy of that state. Now, speaking of that state, remember when Obamacare was passed? There were many states that were making decisive moves. They were trying to outmaneuver Obamacare. North Dakota was one of those states that wasn't really a state, but was trying to outmaneuver Obamacare. And I thought it would be important for us to look at this because Obamacare is a huge constitutional issue that no one talks about. So I think it's quite important that we investigate that together so you can understand how important your constitution really is, because you lost the majority of your rights with the Affordable Care Act.
There's big news on the legal front. If you, like I, have been frustrated by the fact that Congress and the White House have not repealed Obamacare, the fascistic medical law, well, this might be for you. The New American's Michael Tennant just reported that on Monday, 20 states' attorneys general, headed by the Texas AG and Wisconsin AG, have brought suit to bring down the rest of Obamacare. It's a very interesting argument, and I'll give it been 2 years, sort of in two prongs. First, we have to go back to 2017. In late 2017, the White House and the Republicans in Congress passed a so-called tax reform bill that, as part of it, removed the mandate to have to buy health insurance that individuals had to do.
I tell people specifically, be quiet with the fake news media because I don't want them talking too much about it, because I didn't know how people would. But now that it's approved, I can say the individual mandate on health care, where you had to pay not to have insurance. Okay, think of that one. You pay not to have insurance. The individual mandate has been repealed.
Now, why is this key? Well, for that, we go back to the second prong of it. And that goes back to 2009 and 2010, when they were arguing in Congress and the White House that they had to pass Obamacare. Of course, you couldn't see it.
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
Part of it was a mandate that you had to buy health insurance. The Obama administration said, oh, by the way, this is just a tax. This isn't a fine or anything like that.
For us to say that you've got to take a responsibility to get health insurance is absolutely not a tax increase.
Now, they used that term so that people would more readily accept it. But when later in 2012, a Supreme Court case was brought against Obamacare called NFIB v. Sebelius, the Supreme Court realized that they could actually not hear the case if it was termed a tax. Why? Because in 1867, there was something called the Anti-Injunction Act that was passed. And that stipulates that no one can bring suit about a tax unless they have actually paid it. And at that time, the tax had not been paid. It wasn't instituted until 2014. So in order to hear the case, the Supreme Court said, oh no, it's not a tax, it's a fine. Then, when they found that everything was hunky-dory in some ridiculous Supreme Court fashion, that the Obamacare mandates were perfectly fine on both insurance companies and individuals, they said, oh, by the way, we were wrong. It's actually not a fine, it's a tax.
Today's decision was a victory for people all over this country.
Get it? So they went completely circular. Now, why is that key? The reason is because in the argument that was laid down in district court on Monday, the attorneys general noted that part of Obamacare says that the mandate, the insurance mandate, the tax that the IRS can take from you if you don't pay is an inseparable part of the whole package of Obamacare. And they're saying that since this was repealed, all of Obamacare must be null and void. This is huge. Now, we don't know if this goes to the Supreme Court, what they will actually rule. And I'm a little bit frustrated because one major aspect of this, which is the mandates for guaranteed issue that have been applied to insurance companies, those aren't being addressed. But this is a very, very big deal, and I hope people will watch it. After that, perhaps they can address the ridiculous idea that insurance companies have to cover people with pre-existing conditions, because all that does is inspire young people to drop their policies, making rates go way up, and of course, getting people very angry at the insurance companies. But that's a separate issue from this lawsuit. We're going to watch this very closely, and some of us might actually have our fingers crossed about this. For MRC TV, I'm Gardner Goldstein.
My gosh, this microphone is driving me insane today. All right, so what I was saying was it was evil unleashed. Pages and pages worth of unconstitutional mandates. And Obamacare was a mandate, which they used a loophole in verbiage and wordsmithing to make it a tax. And therefore, they can't this. And therefore, it's allowed. And that was to address only one portion of it, which was you're forcing people to pay for not having health insurance. That's weird. And then people that buy health insurance don't use the health insurance because they can't afford to use the health insurance because it's too expensive too. So it is the most atrocious thing ever done within our nation, because that gave power to the hospitals. This is why when you go in, they lock you up. And they sign you in under a special, I would say, title when you come in, unvaccinated with pneumonia. And suddenly they own you. Death panels, very real. Judges stand in between. I mean, we couldn't even get a cop to go in and check because apparently COVID is so dangerous. You have no rights once you enter a hospital. Oh, you don't think so? Well, you're learning. You're learning. You're seeing it now. You're seeing exactly how they operate. Today is Constitution Day, so it's important that we learned a few things about our Constitution. So I'm going to end it today with a little snippet of a few little screen grabs of the documentary that will be coming soon once it's fine-tuned and perfect. I want you guys to enjoy this and brace yourselves because hopefully you'll understand how everything is indeed just a show.
We've got a revealing look inside of one of Hollywood's biggest talent agencies and some of the people who helped shape A-list careers.
They have packaged some of the most successful movies ever made, booked the world's highest grossing concerts, and they control the profitable domain of television.
D-A-I-D-N-U-T-A, which one?
Well, it's a small agency off the 101.
Gross.
20 years ago, an industry phenomenon was formed by a band of renegade agents from the bowels of the formidable William Morris Agency.
There's kind of a paradox of sorts, right? Very few people outside of Hollywood know what CA is or those initials, and yet it follows us all day.
Yeah, isn't that that place in Langley?
No. You mean where everybody spies on each other?
It's CA.
20 years ago, I really thought there were only two agencies. One was the KGB and one was the CIA.
People love to make a big deal out of an event like this. It's the Hollywood, Washington connection, West Coast, East Coast, whatever it is. People love to make a big deal out of it. And I think it's in part because of some of the similarities between your world and the political world.
Special word of thanks to so many of you in this audience who worked for me in the last election, who made appearances for me, who helped to raise funds and helped to make arguments and who stood up for me in the face of it's pretty wilting criticism. So when I was upstairs meeting some of you, it was interesting to me what was mentioned going through the line. Some people said, I'm really glad you fought so hard for NAFTA and passed it. Others said, I'm glad you're trying to get a new World Trade Agreement through GATT, but I'm glad you're fighting for the interest of the entertainment industry while you're doing it.
When was the last time we ever heard a president attack, quote, the deep state, end quote? He's not attacking some rogue outfit in Afghanistan that's an offshoot and maybe under contract. He's attacking the military-industrial complex's core secrecy operations.
You think I don't know these people? I'm not looking at this from the outside. I have a lot of experience. I know she's married to a CIA agent. Do the math. Who's behind Time's Up? CIA. Where do they meet? CIA. Who needs good PR? CIA. Who are part of the pimp problem? CIA.
These are very powerful people you're talking about.
They are. So am I.
All right, guys. So that was just a snippet of a very, very analytical and very deep dive into an agency that seems to be running agencies over agencies over agencies over agencies globally. And if you noticed during that snippet, right next to Will Smith as an actor, the fake president, the one who they selected was right next to him as an extra, as an actor, right? That you can book him. Everything is just a movie that is orchestrated to shackle your mind and believe the reality that they have constructed. And the reason that you feel trapped is because you haven't realized that you can just pretty much stand up in the movie theater and say, fuck this. No, I'm the consumer. I'm not going to be allowed to be consumed. This is why I ask, are you a spectator or a participant? And for those that participated and weren't very obedient, well, they got other treatments like this song by Tom McDonald. Pay attention. Yeah.
The Illuminati know the answers, taking bone samples to clone rappers. But the artists in prison to silence their vision, genetic copies going home after. They look different, eyes shifted, smile missing, skin lifted, it's scientific. If they can't control you, they erase the old you, get your duplication to enforce their message. They clone Gucci, clone Kodak, clone Eminem, he ain't raps his encore, know that. Cloning rappers when they overdose to keep making money from producing more tracks. The game is a sham, turning the artists who challenge to sacrificial lambs. The labels and devils are shaking hands, creating our artists in labs.
Executions have been televised, oh. They're on TMZ like every night. They take our heroes, give us weaponized clones. The revolution won't be televised.
I can't be replicated.
Copy the attitude and it changed, but no one will ever do me the same.
I can't be replicated.
Try to control me, then guess again. Rebellion lives in my DNA.
I can't be replicated.
Duplicated, imitated, fabricated, eliminated. No, I can't be replicated. The system designed me to be a slave. I'm the pitch in the matrix that can't escape.
I can't be replicated.
If they killed the rappers who were spitting truth, they wouldn't have a messenger to reach the youth. So they duplicate physically, implant abilities, replicate tattoos and cloning facilities. Indie contracts say worldwide, label contracts say universal. For all of time and all forms, they own all your music, your image, your name, and your person. Weird, right? I know you don't think that is facts, but for 50,000 and a hair sample, you can clone your dog or your dying cat. It's another way for them to win the war by weaponizing important celebrities. Don't kill your foes, just clone their gods. Then you'll control all your enemies.
The executions have been televised, though. They're on TV.
And all I see is propaganda. Propaganda. And all I see is propaganda.
Wow. Biden, the king of Nightmarica. God bless everyone. See you on Sunday for movie night.
And all I see is propaganda. Propaganda. And all I see is propaganda. Propaganda.
Yeah. United we stand, divided we fall. New Year's Eve, they've been dropping the ball. Independent, how we dead in the game. We don't write to the sound of applause. In the truth, dotted lines ain't never signed, stood, and remain the boss. In a world that is full of facades, where if you speak, you get nailed to a cross. I won't be silent, I am outspoken. I am the product of pain, so when you see my name, no fame could never break down a brain that is already broken. Every wound is a pain devotion. They fill words as I purge emotions. Scabs hair as I drop hits that bleed loud from demonic omens. The system decides we spend and we buy, while most of our time is spent in bed. The dreams we have all stay inside. We sleep and wake and live with regret. The price of life is half the cost. The price of fame could cost your head. If infamy is what you seek, in propaganda.